Hawaii Talks. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Why don't our streets and highways hold up better? It's a question many motorists have long been asking. Well, guess what? The state has begun repaving the Pali Highway with a new asphalt mix. It is more expensive, but officials tell us it may last longer. We talked to Highways Administrator Ed Sniffen about the change.
For us, as we went forward, when we look back on our typical policies for state highways over the past couple of decades, our pavement preservation program has always been to look at the worst roads, rip out the AC in that worst road, put in a new layer of AC, and call it fixed. I mean, that was our pavement preservation. So in reality, it was a worst first approach, and it was an expensive one because a reconstruction of a roadway costs us about $750,000 per mile. And that's on average, and that's just on an AC road.
Asphalt
road. So when we look at that $750,000 cost, every year, if our costs are that big, the amount of road that we can take care of is very limited. So what we're putting in place right now, this is in conjunction with other states that are putting together their asset management programs, and with the federal government allowing us to look into these different methodologies. We're putting together an asset management program for our roads to prioritize roads based on a benefit cost, not on a worst first. So in reality, when we start looking at things, the considerations we have are definitely condition of the roadway. And for the federal government, they look at three things: the cracking of the roads, rutting in the wheel paths, and the rideability. So in reality, the formula is how many 1-inch bumps per mile you hit. If it's less than 80, it's in good condition. So that's something like you could look at Likelike that we just paved. On the Big Island, there's Queen Kei up there. And on Maui, most of their main roads are in good condition. That's about less than 80. If it's about 170, it's in poor condition. If you look at H1 before we repaved it, that was 170. Pali right now, it's more than 170. So you don't have to go far to look at examples of poor roads. So when we look at those three factors, we judge everything based on those three. We look at a prioritization based on the three factors alone. But then we got to add in other things, the volume of the road. In IAEA, that H1 corridor takes 270,000 vehicles. That's automatically a priority. Pali, 60,000 vehicles per day. Definitely a high volume compared to the rest of the state. Pumps it up into a higher priority. You look at the North Shore, the roads are not in very good condition out there, but we get about 12,000 vehicles per day. So when you look at the benefit to the cost that we'd put into it, it's very low compared to the high volume roads. So that's one thing. We also got to look at, once we repave a road, if we don't touch it for the next 15 years, we will reconstruct it within that next 15 years. So we're going to put in that $750,000 per mile at that time. Or we could look at, once we repave it, we look at in 3 years doing some kind of pavement preservation methodology, whether we seal the cracks to make sure water doesn't go in, whether we seal, put in a seal to ensure that when the pavement is oxidized and starts breaking down, we can add in more emulsifiers to ensure that it stays supple. It doesn't get too rigid and doesn't start cracking. We can look at chip seals to make sure that we can reinforce it a bit. All of those are about 15,000 to 50,000 per mile versus the 750,000. In general, our methodology is good roads cost less. So if we can keep those good roads in good condition longer, it'll reduce the cost that we all have. So if we never get an increase in our fees, if we see a decrease in the way we collect revenues, we can still manage the public's expectations on the quality of our roads.
Okay, well, let's circle back to the Pali, because I understand that you folks are starting to pave that and you're using a new mix.
Yes, we are. It's called a stone matrix. Stone matrix mix. So our typical mix that we use is a mix four. And that's what we call it anyway, asphalt concrete mix. In that mix, we have a graded aggregate that's pretty small, and we add asphalt binder to it. When we transition to this stone matrix pavement, it's a larger aggregate that allows us to put more asphalt into it. And into that asphalt, to make sure that it binds well and stays binded for a long time, whether it's oxidized or not, we add in a polymer. We also add in fibers. So that helps the binder to keep that thing strong. If you want to see an example of a stone matrix that we had put in, we put it on Moanalua Freeway, going both eastbound and westbound, between the Middle Street Merge and Alakapuna, the overpass that comes over at Salt Lake. In that area, you'll see that the pavement in that area is gray, but there's no cracks in it. There's no crack seals.
So when did we put that in?
16 years ago.
Wow.
It's in really good condition. Because you can see it, and you know where the joint is, because once you get out of that area, you see a bunch of crack seal throughout on both the east side and the west side.
So we're doing that for Pali right now?
Yes. So we're putting it for Pali. It's about the material cost for that type of mix is about 1.8 times our normal mix for. But the installation is not 1.8 times. Installation is maybe about 1.3 to 1.5 times. It's more expensive, definitely. But the normal mix 4 lasts me 13 years if I don't do anything. This has already gone 16 years without anything being done to it, which means I can easily see that it's going to last us 20 years minimum. So the life that we buy on this means that there's less interruption on traffic because I don't have to do anything more on the road. There's also less cost as we go to maintain it. So it's definitely, from a benefit cost perspective, really, really good compared to our normal mix.
Okay, so why didn't we do this sooner?
I'm not sure. You know, the thing is, I think asphalt has always been asphalt. Moving forward with the same mix is easy. We have the specifications for it. The industry knows it. Industry knows how to put it in. We know how to inspect it. When we move forward on this stone matrix, the industry has to bring in new equipment, has to bring in the polymers and the fibers. When you install stone matrix, it's not like normal AC. If you put the normal AC mix on the ground, you can work it and you can move it. Stone matrix, if you mess it up, you rip it out and you put in another mix.
Okay, not as user-friendly.
Not as user-friendly. So you really got to pay attention to the details as you go forward. Now, it's not something that scares anybody. It's just that's something you got to prepare for.
Does it need inspectors?
Absolutely. So our inspectors are all being qualified for it to make sure that we inspect the mix, the components of the mix, and the installation itself. So all of this would be is to ensure that what we put in the place or put in the ground is something when the public pays for it, they can be proud of it.
So do it right. Do it right the first time.
Absolutely. And it can stay right for the next 20 years.
Okay. So I know the county is experimenting with the different sealants, too, on the city and county roads. And I think that's work in progress, right?
Absolutely.
But I know it is maddening after a rain to see these giant potholes erupt on your way to work.
Absolutely.
It's frustrating.
And those potholes you'll see in the same areas all the time. Until we come through and reconstruct it, make sure we take out the base that's been damaged, and that's what a pothole is. It's not the AC that broke down. It's the base course underneath it that broke down. So we got to reconstruct the whole structure of the pavement down below, come back up, and make sure we put in a mix that's going to stay in place for a while.
Okay, so hopefully by the time the Pali tunnels open up again like normal and the motorists will see hopefully new repaved roads and they'll last longer.
Absolutely. So the plan right now is to finish up that Pali structure in August. And at that time, because the contractor knows he has the closure during this period, all of the work is being accelerated.
That's great.
So all the town bond work will be done by the time that the Pali opens up again. And it'll be done with this new mix, with a stronger mix, and with a better condition.
Okay, so silver lining. We weren't expecting the tunnel closure, but at least the work will get done faster.
Absolutely.
And so they'll be even out the grief, I guess, for motorists.
And we really appreciate the public's patience in all of this. The support that we've been getting from the public to make sure they tell us they understand the situation and that they want us to fix it right has been tremendous.
So I was on the internet trolling around and was looking at mixes, and I saw somewhere in England that there's a guy that is using plastic to help build what he thinks are stronger roads. It's a startup. But, you know, that could solve some of our problems potentially if we can reuse our plastics that we bring in and generate here on island. Why not try and make a stronger road with it?
Absolutely. So what he's doing is using the plastic as the fibers to increase the binder, which is a really good idea. For us, we've been looking at these green solutions throughout. We have a CO2 entrained concrete that we're going to be using. The CO2 not only strengthens the concrete mix, to make sure that we could potentially reduce the amount of cement that we use in the concrete. But it also helps us get rid of some of the CO2 that's created through our industries. We're looking at this at these other options to try and make our pavements that we're putting in place more green. This sounds like a great one.
That was Ed Sniffen, State Highways Administrator, talking about changing the asphalt mix on repaving projects. It's being put in place now on the Pali Highway here on Oahu, and the next project in line for that facelift, Nimitz Highway. This change comes as the state is looking for public input on a proposed new road usage charge. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. You know, the image of Hawaii as a vacationer's paradise? Well, it's not always accurate, or at least that's what one prominent writer learned when he was sent by the editor of Running Magazine to do a story on the Honolulu Marathon in 1980. The result of that trip was not your standard journalistic report. Instead, it was a dark story about the author's experiences on Oahu and the Big Island. The memoir, The Curse of Lono, was published in 1983, but was considered a flop and went out of print shortly thereafter. What author ventured into our backyard with a vacation in mind and ended up with a travel horror story instead? Bonus points if you can name the illustrator who accompanied him for a portion of the trip. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
March is National Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Month. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show to learn about who is at risk for brain injuries and what services are available locally to help. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Ohana Solar is backed by a Korean energy company, and it has its sights set on using some of our best agriculture lands in Konya for a massive solar farm. Lawmakers introduced bills in both houses to pave a way for the project. The Senate bill failed early on, but House Bill 593 scaled the Water and Land and Technology Committee and is now headed to the powerful Money Committee for passage. Senator Gil Riviere is speaking out against the move to use Grade A ag lands in this way and questions the track that the bill is taking. Some believe it sidesteps the conference committee process. Also lining up against the measure, the State Agriculture Department, the Hawaii Farm Bureau, and scores of environmental groups. Those who support it say we have to look at our ag lands in a different way. But here's Senator Gil Riviere's take on the issue.
We are trying to save agriculture land, and at least I am. And I think most people want to see more local food production. We have for years talked about preserving and saving and enhancing important agriculture lands. And by definition, these lands are grade A lands. They are the very best of the last remaining available acreage for farming. So putting an industrial use and tying up hundreds of acres for solar panels on our very limited quality lands just doesn't make sense to me if we're going to really support agriculture.
Is this in your district?
It's just outside of my district. It's close. It's near the boundary.
And who has the final say?
Chair De La Cruz of Ways and Means will be have a large say in what happens next. And then should it pass Ways and Means, it'll go to the Senate for a final vote in the Senate.
I'm a little puzzled. Why does it have to go to Ways and Means?
That's a good question. Another interesting element of this particular bill is that the Senate version was assigned to the Agriculture and Environment Committee, but the House version did not go to the Agriculture and Environment Committee. So it's funny that the same bill would have different referrals and go to different committees.
There has been this push for us to be sustainable and to grow our food that we eat without having to import it. We have seen the pushback with Ho'opili because those were prime ag lands out on the west side. If I recall, there was some move by the state and the counties, I think, to identify some of our prime ag lands.
There is a process underway for the counties to identify important ag lands. The land classifications A, B, C, D, and E have long been kind of determined. And, you know, we have 1.8 million acres of agricultural lands in the state, and there's only 56,000 acres left of our A-grade lands, the very best lands. And Ho'opili took out about 12,000 acres of prime land, and it would just be terrible to see more land going to uses other than agriculture.
And what have been the arguments for this proposal?
They're arguing that by allowing other uses of the land, it will help subsidize the farming operations. But it's not clear to me how that works if the foreign national solar developer is paying rent to the land owner. I don't see the connection necessarily on how anyone leasing the land to grow food would benefit. I see it as a direct competition. If we're trying to stimulate agriculture and farmers for vegetables and food crops are having a difficult time getting long-term leases at affordable lease, and now they have to compete against a commercial enterprise that's more profitable, I don't see how the regular farmers are going to survive. I think this is just going to push them over the cliff.
So you have yet to see the justification for the ag component?
No, I really don't believe that there's a valid justification. If we're stimulating, if we're trying to protect agriculture, I don't see how putting a more profitable enterprise that is not agriculture on that land can sustain, you know, food farming.
What do we have in place now regarding this issue? Why do we need this bill to allow this a large solar scale project to spring up there?
Several years ago, I was on the House Agriculture Committee, and we allowed, at that time, solar farms to be put on C-grade lands. And I remember the chair of the committee telling me, he said, well, this is probably a pretty good idea. But his concern at that time was that we're allowing solar farms on C-grade land now. Watch out, they'll be coming back for the B and the A-grade lands. And lo and behold, that's where we are today. They're going after the last of the land. And there is a lot of agriculture land, there's a lot of rooftops, there's a lot of places you could put solar panels. I don't see why they need to be on our best ag lands.
I did talk to a farmer in your district, a North Shore farmer who raises sheep. And I know at the time that they were trying to breed as many sheep as possible because they saw these large scale projects springing up and they wanted to be able to be part of it and have the lambscapers, if you will, the sheep, keep the grass down. And there was also hope that there would be an industry for the lamb, you know, in the restaurants and that kind of a thing. But I think there is a concern about not having like a mobile slaughterhouse or a slaughterhouse that will take smaller animals like sheep and pigs.
That has been a concern for a while. The slaughterhouse over in West Oahu has new ownership now. They are very focused on beef production, which is great. But I do believe that they've got something set aside. They've got a part of the slaughterhouse for the smaller animals. But I do know scheduling has been problematic for some of the other animals.
Yeah, we understand that's an issue also, I think, on the Big Island for the industries there. But getting back to this solar project, so you just haven't seen enough of the pluses for small farmers in this deal.
No, I'm absolutely against this proposal. I don't see any salvation in it. I think we've got to draw the line and save our prime lands for agriculture and finding a more profitable use for it to do something else other than growing food on our best ag land is going backwards.
In reviewing the testimony, I saw that there was opposition from, you know, the Hawaii Farm Bureau, the Department of Agriculture, for this very reason. But we did have two prominent names, Richard Hoff from the Big Island and Dean Okimoto from Nalu Farms, coming out in support of it. Because when I talked to them, they said we need to look at farming in a different way, that the small farmers are under so many stresses that we've got to think differently about this.
So in that hearing, I asked Dean, I said, when you were farming, because neither of these guys are farming anymore. So when you were farming, did you consider putting solar panels on your sheds and your roads and your parking areas to subsidize, you know, your electric, to discount your cost of electricity? I said, no, it didn't work out. You know, they didn't do it. So I don't think people object to a farmer generating electricity maybe on their barns or their sheds or their workshops. And that was the justification for putting solar onto the B-grade land, was we're only going to put it on the roads and our buildings. But you see, that's just been blown open now. Now there's going to be almost no restraint on solar panels competing for ag land. So, I just don't see how it can possibly stimulate more food production. Thank you for your interest in this, Catherine. I think this is an easy one. There are many, many issues where we can disagree on the merits or the solution or, well, I just disagree with you that this isn't right. But this is really, to me, a very, very clear question. Are we going to save the ag land or not? It's as simple as that. And I everybody that I meet, everybody, everywhere, Facebook and all over, is clear. Let's save the ag land. So I don't support this bill, and I hope it does not pass.
That was Senator Gil Riviere questioning the passage of House Bill 593, which allows our best agricultural lands to be used for solar farms. We did reach out to the Ways and Means Chair, Senator Donna Medela Cruz, last week, but have not heard back about plans to schedule the bill for a hearing. We hope to hear from the company later this week. Lobbyist Noni Toledo tells us company representatives are traveling.
I'm Dave Awakawa from the Land Use Research Foundation of Hawaii and a member of HPR. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today we take you out to the harbors where the price of living aboard your boat is about to get even pricier. Kirsten Downey's on the line with us. Good morning.
Hello, I'm delighted to speak with you.
Yes, your headline, the boat people of the Alawa. I fear they're getting forced out.
Yes. I'm afraid this is just another face of gentrification in Hawaii. Of course, you know, this is an 11-acre parcel, which is the Alawai Small Boat Harbor. That's right on the Ala Moana waterfront as you approach into Waikiki. The harbor there was built in the 50s and 60s, so it's fallen into some serious disrepair. But that's also given a lot of people an opportunity to have a pretty inexpensive life with a beautiful view of the Pacific Ocean.
Right, and those are the liveaboards, right? The folks that are
those
actually...
Those are the liveaboards.
Yeah, that they call their boats home.
They do. There's more than 100 boats there, and we don't know exactly how many people live there in total, because some live there illegally as well.
Right, and that has been a big issue for the Division of Boating in DLNR, I know, because they're really not supposed to live there.
No, they're not. Really, it was Ed Underwood, the administrator of the what they call DOBAR, which is the Division of Boating and Ocean Recreation, which is a part of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, says that it was never intended to become a permanent housing settlement. It was never that the boat harbor was never intended to be a permanent home site. But as costs have gotten more and more expensive for many people, living on a boat at the Alawai has become sort of a home of last resort, and for many, a really delightful experience as well.
Yes, I love the line where he says they're not supposed to be floating condos.
Right. Well, the boats are, anyone who could go over to the harbor should go and take a look. These are varying degrees of boats, you might say, from the most tumble down dinghy to some very beautiful yachts. It shows sort of the whole range of the boating community. But the people who are most afraid are the moderate income and lower income people who've managed to make a life for themselves in what has become some of the most expensive real estate in the world. I met one man who lives on a 38-foot power boat there, and he pays $515 a month rent for his slip. Obviously, much cheaper than it would cost for any kind of an apartment in Honolulu. The Department of Land and Natural Resources, of course, says that's just way too little money, and they want to raise the rates so that they can modernize the facility and make repairs. The boaters say there's been mismanagement, and that if the money that they were paying was properly invested back into the property, that the property would be in much better condition.
And they haven't.
As you can imagine, the relations between the two parties at times have become quite poisonous.
Yes, and the rates haven't been raised really in quite a long time, though.
By some reports, since 1991.
And there have been lots of discussions about redeveloping that property there. There was that failed attempt by Honeybee, the Japanese company, to develop it. And there was concern then, but obviously we're back to square one. What do we do about those boats?
That's exactly true. Of course, there's legislation now that will raise the rates. And there's also a strategic plan by the Department of Land and Natural Resources that would really call for really redeveloping that area. They think that the state could get a lot more revenue out of it if they redeveloped it into a more upscale kind of marina. Perhaps a privately run marina is what they'd like to do. And, of course, that's what terrifies the boaters. They feel like it's been a state-managed facility that has been welcoming to low and moderate-income people. And if these changes happen, that last pocket of community, what they feel is a very vibrant neighborhood, could be lost.
Right. It's interesting. So you wonder where they will go.
Well, some said they thought they'd probably end up sharing a room with someone somewhere.
Yeah.
Or maybe some could end up homeless.
Or maybe they'll go find another neighbor island. Who knows?
Well, there's only two harbors in the state that permit liveaboards. That's part of the problem. And, of course, you know, there are a lot of wealthy people that have expensive yachts that would like those slips, especially if the marina were fixed up.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks so much, Kirsten.
Thank you.
That was reporter Kirsten Downey with today's Reality Check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org.
This week's On the Media, after Christchurch, a debate about how to understand evil without spreading evil. Archivists of hate groups argue it is possible.
If their internal messages get exposed and it shows how they're trying to manipulate people into buying into what they're selling, it makes them look weaker.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
This evening at 7.
Well, the dust is just starting to settle after an emotional land auction on the Garden Isle Friday. HPR's Ku'uwehi Hirishi gives us a closer look at the Kuleana land deal.
That's right, Catherine. Good morning. It was emotional would probably be the best way to describe it. And trying to speak to some of these family members afterward, it was very raw. But I was able to pull some of the audio from that exchange and watching the commissioner, court-appointed commissioner, sort of auction off these land parcels. So four land parcels from north on the north shore of Kauai and Pila'a, very small parcels. The largest was about 1.5 acres, but going for, in total, all four parcels were sold at auction, or tentatively sold at auction, for about $1.7 million. And so what we have now in this particular situation, for those who may not have been following, it's basically a land dispute between members of the same family. These Kuleana lands were originally gotten back in the 1800s, and that land ownership, those land ownership rights, transfer generation to generation. So at this point, we've got hundreds of descendants, all with a fractional claim to these, what, little over 2 acres, something like that. And so the only possible solution, at least on the court or within the law, was for the court to order a land sale to see if who can actually take ownership of these lands. So this is part of that auction.
I have a bid, 700.
Holy crap!
I'm all in. 700.
Why are we buying all
what?
Oh, yeah, never know.
700 twice. Okay, 700 three times.
That's all I know. 700,000 for our I know. 125 years.
Buying our own property.
It was a bit both daunting and humiliating to show up and hold your head high and bid on something that, as a matter of property law, from an Anglo-American point of view, and from a cultural proposition that you owned and were stewards of.
So that was Wayne Raposo. He is a descendant with ancestral claims to this land. He's also a corporate finance lawyer in London right now. So he's been dealing with Brexit, but also trying to organize some of his family members that are still on Kauai to be able to bid at auction. So $700,000 was the bid on the first parcel, which was 0.12 acres, very small, couple of square feet, but it was the one lot that Raposo was able, and that fraction of Raposo family members were able to tentatively win at the auction. Now, their cousin, Carlos Andrade, who brought about this quiet title lawsuit, he bid on the other three parcels and was also able to tentatively have them in his name, at least for now. So there are a couple more steps before the ownership actually transfers. The one does require a court confirmation hearing where rebids are actually possible. So I say tentative earlier because in this court confirmation hearing, the other parties or anyone else outside of these family members or original bidders can go in and try to bid on these parcels for, you know, if they want to take part of it in that. But
that would be an upset.
It would. Yeah. And in speaking with Raposo, he said, yes, we have some money left over. So it's a possibility that we could win some of those other three parcels. But it's also a possibility that someone could come in and take that $700,000 bid that they put out there and take it away from them. So it's a double-edged sword in that respect. But they're hoping, the Raposos that are sort of holding out their ownership in it, they're hoping that they can have a settlement or have settlement discussions with their cousin, Carlos Andrade, but also with entities related to Mark Zuckerberg. So as we know, these parcels are within that 700-acre property that Zuckerberg purchased in Pila'a. And so Wayne Raposo was hoping that maybe we don't even need to go through with the rebid or with the auction. Maybe we can settle this outside of court. So this is what he had to say to that.
We want to have access to the Kuleana. We would want to sort of be able to own it in a meaningful way. And we would actually agree in all practical terms with something that had a degree of respect for his safety and his family, in the case of Mark and his family. There would be so much room for common ground is what we think.
So initially, what I think going back 2 years, when Mark Zuckerberg initially put through his quiet title lawsuit he was going to file. That included not only the Raposo family Kuleana, but all Kuleana. And since then, he's been sort of talking to the other Kuleana landowners. But this particular quiet title suit came from within the family. And so they're hoping that even though it's within the family, that perhaps because the bigger picture is this entire 700-acre property, that they could have those conversations directly with that with the Facebook CEO. But in talking more about what we can do going forward and to prevent situations like this where families have to buy back their land and or have to settle these disputes in court, Raposo was mentioning, on top of the mandatory mediation talks that we have at the legislature, that perhaps companies need in the real estate agent industry could come up with their own policies to kind of guide how they deal with Kuleana landowners.
Analogous to having a policy on diversity, which many large companies and small companies would have, beyond having a policy on environmental sustainability, I think in Hawaii, a major company should have protocol and policy of, on cultural and kuleana matters, here are the 10 points that are guiding principles that we will abide by in engaging with kuleana families that own property within an area we manage, and we will abide by these 10 general principles, not too detailed, that show that people have at least thought about the issues of the day, to actually have people feel that they count and they matter, and to prevent this ugly conflict that we've been living for the past 2 years.
That's right. So alongside the auction, there was another lawsuit filed last week by members of the family complaining about sort of tactics that lawyers have been taking to try to get these families to sell their shares. So we'll probably hear more about that lawsuit in the next couple of weeks.
Well, I recall when Mr. Facebook decided to buy those hundreds of acres on Kauai, everybody was like, you know, their eyebrows kind of like raised. What does this mean, right? And then to know that then this little, these little parcels within that area, I guess he backed off because of the sensitivity.
Right, right. He did back off because of concerns over these sort of small families with not a lot of money being forced out. But no conversations, I think, at that point were really had in the broader context of the community. It's just been lawyers directly dealing with each and every Kuleana landowner trying to get them to sell.
Right, so we'll see what happens. Thanks so much. That was HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi talking about a recent auction of Kuleana lands on Kauai. You can read her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we are very fortunate to have the services of astronomer Christopher Phillips available to us, and we welcome him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week, stargazers look out for Mars in the western sky after sunset, where it will be visible till around 10 p.m. The moon this week is passing through its last quarter phase and will, of course, herald a return of dark skies, perfect for stargazing.
I got an excited email from Christopher that he has news about gravitational waves, one of his favorite topics. What do you have for us?
Indeed. When we talk about observatories here on Stargazer, we are often referring to large ground-based or radio telescopes or even space telescopes. But in recent years, we have seen a whole new branch of astronomy open up, that of gravitational wave astronomy. And this requires no telescopes at all. It is one of the most exciting areas in astronomy, and it is developing rapidly. The Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO for short, is its premier instrument for this sort of science, and it recently got a major upgrade.
And for the rest of us who have no idea about how this stuff works, try to fill us in how we explore the universe with this tool.
Well, LIGO does not collect light as a traditional telescope would do. Instead, it detects gravitational waves propagating through space by using a system of sensitive lasers. When the gravitational waves pass through the detector, they create tiny variations in space-time which disturb the lasers and tell us something big has happened out there.
And these gravitational waves must be produced by some pretty heavy stuff. Give us an example.
Some of the first observations made with LIGO were of extreme astrophysical phenomena like merging black holes or colliding neutron stars, things we called kilonova.
And so what's the upgrade?
Well, basically, astronomers and engineers have reduced the amount of noise in the detector. So this basically means that we will be able to pick out actual signals more easily.
And with this new field in astronomy expanding so rapidly, are there other facilities that are also being built to do this kind of thing?
There are indeed. In fact, in Japan, the Kagura Observatory is expected to go online in the next few years, allowing us to create a detection network that is much larger. And this will help us detect, and more accurately, some of the sources of these mysterious gravitational waves.
It's Christopher Phillips and another exciting report here on Stargazer. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Earlier in the show, we asked you about the book, The Curse of Lono, which received little accolade after its publication in 1983. It remained in print only for a short time. It was based on Hunter S. Thompson's 1980 working vacation, where he covered the Honolulu Marathon and then spent some R&R time on the Big Island. Much like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the book is a memoir of his working assignment, laced with tales of drugs and misadventure. If you're a fan of Hunter's gonzo journalism, you probably knew today's bonus answer, too. The book was illustrated by his friend and longtime collaborator, Ralph Steadman. Now, in 2005, The Curse of Lono once again blipped on the reading public's radar after being re-released in a limited run of 1,000 copies. Then in November of 2017, director Steve Pink was tapped to helm the film adaptation of the book for Rhino Films. The winner today was Leo Amador of Honolulu. You got it right. This was a very popular quiz. A lot of listeners read this collectible book. A lot of readers and runners out there. But that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Pinay Power. That's how a conference getting underway this week in Honolulu is being billed. Filipino lawyers are banding together in an effort to strengthen their network. The idea was hatched by Bay Area attorney Christine Mari Palma-Start. She's a deputy public defender and launched the Pinay Power Collective 3 years ago.
The Pinay Powerhouse is an empowerment conference. It's focused on Filipino lawyers or aspiring lawyers, so law students or people that are interested. And it's an empowerment conference catered towards helping these individuals be leaders in the legal field. Filipinos themselves, I think, we're still an emerging constituency of attorneys. Particularly, I think, Pinay's, you know, it's probably half and half. I can't say for sure. We don't have the statistics out there exactly. These are more guesstimates, educated guesses in terms of numbers, but specifically, I kind of just fell into this idea because for the last few years I've been very focused on my own personal development and noticed, at least as a woman lawyer, that at least for me in particular, as a woman and as a person of color, the field, at least for lawyers, is you feel like a minority. You are a minority, but you actually feel it. In law school, half of the law school is is specifically white-dominated, especially as you go upper in the ranks, dominated by males. And I was just kind of taking a particular interest in my own self-development, going through coaching and going to different conferences. And I didn't really feel, I felt alone. And I would be the only Filipina lawyer, like in the room at different conferences, or I would go to women conferences and I'd be the only Filipino there. And I just felt like, gosh, the things that I'm learning at these conferences, especially like women conferences, were really valuable. And I wanted access to that space for people like me where we felt welcomed. And so I felt like a particular, I don't know, maybe a responsibility or a duty to be able to provide that kind of space for intimacy and discussion of different struggles and stories and connection and sisterhood that, you know, I didn't think that we had yet.
This is the third conference that you folks are putting on. Where was the first one?
The first one was in San Francisco. It was hosted by the Filipino Bar Association of Northern California in 2017. I think it was the first weekend in March. And we picked March because it's also Women's History Month.
The second one, was that also in California?
It was. It was in Los Angeles. That was hosted by the Philippine American Bar Association of the Greater Los Angeles area.
Given that we're in a time now where immigration is at the forefront, are there a lot of discussions going on amongst the Filipino attorneys?
Yeah, I mean, immigration is huge. I think the climate for talking about and discussing all of the different issues that we're facing with these detention, with separating families, with just even access to the United States and quote-unquote, like, obtaining legal status. It's huge in our community, and I know that at the conference, the Hawaii lawyers who are planning it made sure to include some discussion on that specific topic. It's definitely a feature of the conference. One of the things I kind of wanted to maybe emphasize is that this conference is really about sisterhood. It's really about empowerment. And I think that, you know, at least in the U.S. and Western society, it's you know, we're on the verge of trying to overcome the patriarchy and working together and emphasizing collaboration and not competition. And that's kind of what this conference is about in the sense that, you know, this is all volunteer work. This isn't the kind of conference where we're making any money by any means. There's a fundraiser on Friday. It's a luau at the Elks Lodge that they're hosting that everyone from the community is invited to attend, on Friday evening. But, this is a conference about collaboration and not competition. As I said, we had to get ourselves together and work together. We get on phone calls once a month, a collective of us from different parts of the country, on our own time during mm-hmm. our lunch hours,
right,
or after work hours and weekends to put something like this together because we care. We want people to know that, yeah, we exist. We're women here who want to make a difference in our own communities and be leaders and be examples to other, you know, youth and women who want to, you know, claim space and take space in a field that is dominated by people that don't look like us,
mm-hmm.
that don't understand us, and often, you know, don't even think that we're equal to
right.
them. So for us to be able to have the woman power to do something like this is a huge, is it just a huge challenge in this. I just kind of wanted to give them major up
mm-hmm.
and say that I'm really happy and excited that we're coming to Hawaii and that so many women from different parts of the country are going to be able to attend this year.
So where's the next one?
And showcase. Say it again?
Where's the next one at? Do you know?
We haven't figured that out yet. I'm hoping that, you know, another one of our more established bar associations is willing to take on the task. Mm. I can think of a couple places in the nation that I'd like to invite.
Yeah, is there anywhere on the East Coast or, you know, Chicago?
We would love for the East Coast to do that. So how we kind of run is we have a National Filipino American Lawyers Association that was just birthed a few years ago. The Filipino Bar Association of Northern California, we're 39 years old. And when I came up with the idea and kind of put it to the rest of the board, when I was president of that association, we were all up for it. I had a lot of support, and we had a lot of female attorneys on the board that loved the idea, and so we were able to put it together in San Francisco with a lot of help and support.
START estimates that there are some 3,000 to 6,000 Filipino lawyers out there. The Pinay Powerhouse Conference will cover issues such as social justice and equality, as well as labor issues. It runs March 29th to the 31st at the Alohilani Resort in Waikiki.
It can seem like all political stories come out of Washington, D.C., but really, a lot of stories start where you live. I'm Tamara Keith, and when local politics becomes national news, I want to hear what this station is saying. It helps me to understand the story and share it with listeners across the country and around the world. This station is where the story starts. Help it go further.
HPR members have made it possible for us to tell Hawaii's stories around the world. Donate today on our mobile app.
Our time's up. We have to go. But up tomorrow, remember that $2 surcharge on rental cars the state planned to start charging this year? Well, it's hit a bump in the road. We hope to hear more about it from the state's tax director. If you missed any of our show or want to find a past one, find them on the conversation page at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.